We're in the green room inside what I think is an absolutely beautiful building, Scottish Parliament. Can everybody please introduce themselves?
Hi, I'm Patrick Harvey. I'm a member of the Scottish Parliament for Glasgow, representing the Green Party.
I'm Simon Roberts. I'm a photographer.
I'm Ed. I'm a journalist.
Ed's the only one that doesn't have his telephone voice on. we've just finished a panel. Go on, give us a summary of what it was about and how you think it went.
Well, we were talking about social media in its broadest sense, the various technologies people are using out there and the ways they're using them, the way it impacts on politics as well. We looked at, you know, people's experience from this country, from overseas, and we had a few views from the audience about what people are using social media for as well.
Simon, I've seen you talk a couple of times, but I always get something else out of what you talk about. And today, the whole idea of long form really hit home. Do you want to summarise that?
Is that because I was only talking for 10 minutes?
It's amazing. I had a bet that you couldn't do it.
So you should say I was more succinct today. Is that what you're saying, right? I mean, I suppose my practice is moving much more long form in the sense that I don't feel that I am able to distill what I want to distill in short periods of time, that I can't go and cover something and really understand what I'm trying to do with the work. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is as much about kind of contemplation as it is about the actual producing of the work. So for instance, with the election project, it was about standing back, it was about being on the edge of things in terms of the actual producing the work. But then the distilling of the work was done 7 months after the actual election. So I was showing the photographs, exhibiting the work, publishing a newspaper about the election deliberately a long period after we'd actually had the election, because I wanted people to look at the work in retrospect of how we had experienced the election, you know, in that, rather than just through the 24-hour news media, as a way of just trying to get people to think about something other than that moment where we suddenly get the tweet or the Facebook message, or and actually kind of look back and experience it in, I suppose, in, like you say, the long form.
Which is interesting, because books, I guess, are the long form old media. Newspapers were always called to be yesterday's chit wrapper, because they were pretty much, you can't link to an old newspaper, you can't correct an article. So lots of pros and cons with both. And I'm now reading more since I got a device that enabled me to, the Kindle, on the fly, because I've always got my books in my back pocket. But I am finding it harder to sit down for longer periods of time without...
Well, that is a worrying thing. I mean, I see my daughter on an iPad, and, you know, she's aged 5, and the way she's flicking through it, and the way that she's growing up in terms of the way that she's experiencing media, even at that age, is quite frightening in terms of thinking about how easy it is to get access to information. I mean, it's no longer about walking to somewhere to go to the library to physically then have to take out a book, to then have to sit down and go to the index page and look through it. The whole experience of getting information is so faster now that actually I think in some ways it's quite worrying, because do we accept the first thing that we see on Google ranking? Because, of course, Google actually knows what you want to read. It kind of it automatically understands.
I'd like to think it is actually not knows, it assumes.
Assumes, yeah, but do you know what I mean? It's actually what you're seeing in the first 10 pages of Google is then building up a picture of what you've searched before.
And this needs to be taught in schools as well, because we could Google exactly the same thing and get two totally different results.
You know, so actually the way that we're accessing information is somehow being tailored to what they want us to read about. So, that's a kind of frightening thing.
I've started using Scroogle, actually, for that very reason. It uses the Google back end, but it doesn't remember any of your cookies and is untraceable. Not because I'm searching anything dodgy, I'd like to add, but because it's my quiet little private protest at home. Ed, you've been some interesting places recently across the last few years, but of course, very interesting. You've just stepped out of what is effectively now a police state.
Yeah, I was just in Bahrain about 2 days ago, and what I find there is that it's really interesting, because I was working at the time for the New York Times, and they're all foreign media are essentially banned for, you know, how we covered the uprising. And so it's actually really interesting, because what I found with the Arab Spring, so to speak, and also even before that, is that mainstream media has become almost public enemy number one, as almost seen as the thing that's tipped the scales on what happened in Egypt, on Libya, etc. And so I think now as a journalist, you know, we do have to use social media. We've almost gone underground ourselves. Like, I have to go in as a tourist. I need to report as secretly as I can, and I need to then, like, synthesize that, but also, like, remember that I am working for mainstream media. And so it's actually a bit strange because Bahrain, for example, it is, for all intents and purposes, turned into a police state where people, protesters, journalists, are being systematically targeted and silenced in regards to, you know, their role in the uprising, and they don't want word to get out. And so I think social media and just the way that I now network with my contacts on the ground has become even more important.
So I guess the back channels and the ability to have even limited privacy is really important for you. What were you doing to communicate, in inverted commas, privately?
During that time, we would actually use what we found was that Skype, and also just we would encode messages within Facebook because that would be a bit more secure. We wouldn't, you know, when I was communicating to my sources, you know, we would never use the phone, we would never use text messaging. And maybe I'm just being paranoid, but at the same time, there's very good reason for that. What I was doing there by reporting was effectively illegal. I had to sign a document that swore that I was not a journalist and that I would not engage in any journalistic activities at the airport. And when they confiscated my cameras, when I left, they interrogated me and asked me exactly what I did, who I saw. And again, it's really scary because you basically have to become a journalist very secretively. And it's really sad in a lot of ways. But I think with the tools of social media, you know, it has helped me report better, get better access to people. But at the same time, given technology, if I were to go anywhere and an authoritarian government or a police force were to Google me, they would know immediately that I'm a journalist.
Surely the immigration could just have a Google search
and they
of who Edu is.
And so it's really tough because the same social media and the same, like, you know, connectedness is the same thing that helps Iran or Israel or these governments know exactly who I am as a journalist, what my politics may or may not be, what I report. And so then, you know, like, yeah.
Well, this is why 90% of the time I write under the moniker of documentary as well. The amount of times I get stopped crossing a border because of my colourful travel history is crazy. And quite often it's actually going into America. And it was only recently when I said, no, honestly, Google me and you'll see that I'm not who you think I am. And then I had to correct, actually, no, can you Google documentary? And then when they did, they saw my photograph, they saw videos of me coming over on the plane, all kinds of stuff. And they're like, okay, off you go then. And they were suspicious of my passport because it had no stamps in it. I said, it's a new passport, because they saw my travel history different to my book. So I think the paranoia is a healthy thing.
Right. Well, the one place that, before I started working, in the last lecture, when I first started working, place I worked was Israel-Palestine. And that is one perfect example of this, because when I worked, I was based in Jerusalem shooting for the Associated Press, I would need to have like one byline, and because most Arab countries don't recognize Israel or anyone who's been there, even as a journalist, if I were to go to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Saudi, I have to have this second personality with the second name, with a second passport, and almost pretend that I've never, ever worked as a journalist there.
So you've got, I mean, I know a lot of journalists have two passports, I did for a while, but you have a second passport with a totally different name.
Yeah, I do. It's a bit, well, the thing is for me, I have two nationalities. I was born in Taiwan, so I have a Taiwanese and Canadian passport. And as a Canadian, you're allowed to have two passports specifically for this reason. There's places, let's say, Nagorno-Karabakh or Azerbaijan, Israel-Palestine, and the Arab world, where they know that people need to travel back and forth. Mm. And I just am lucky enough to have a Chinese name, which is totally different from my English name.
That is all kinds of awesome.
Yeah, but at the same time, it then becomes really strange because the number one accusation that most governments level on me is that, are you a spy for Israel? Are you CIA?
Yeah.
And then it's a bit then suspicious for me to have two passports, two different names. You almost, in the way, the steps I have to take to safely report in a lot of places is to actually think like a spy, which then makes me actually a spy.
Yeah.
And it's a bit, it's really strange.
Yeah.
And so
it's
very difficult to work as a journalist now. In Egypt, for example, I get arrested on almost a weekly basis, whether I get arrested by police or protesters themselves turn me in for thinking I'm an Israeli spy. And this sounds funny, but it's actually not. This happens every single day.
How many times do you see? You're going to have to get a T-shirt just saying, Google me. This name.
Well, until they Google me and they see that I've been to the wrong place and interviewed the wrong person.
Well, then all of a sudden... yeah, God, it's as much as a help as it is a hindrance. Do you want to quickly summarise and give a plug to the festival itself? Because you've invited us all here, or at least you've been invited here a lot, but you know more about it than anyone. And there's nobody officially, I don't think, that could speak. They're standing in the background. They are listening. We are being monitored by government workers.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Scottish Parliament, whether in its building or its practices and running events like this, it always wanted not to look like a fortress in the way Westminster looks like a kind of keep out, you don't belong here kind of place, but to be participative. And I think it's always tried in its first dozen years to try and be participative and inclusive and welcoming. The first time I ever sat in the chamber of the Scottish Parliament was as a committee witness before I was ever elected, giving evidence on behalf of the youth group that I worked with about why they should scrap Section 28. And there's no chance that we could have done that if it had been done at Westminster. I felt like I was participating as a member of the public. And so the Festival of Politics is one way of kind of opening the doors during the summer recess when the Parliament's a wee bit quieter. And there are lots and lots of people in Edinburgh for a host of other festivals, open the doors and offer some opportunity to discuss political issues outside of a formal political debate. Okay. And I think with this one, you know, we've got a clear set of opportunities and fascinating experiences that people are having using social media in any relationship to politics. But I think there's still a question mark for me about what's the impact on our politics, on our political landscape that will come from these technologies. I think it's bound to be mixed. There'll be good and bad. Yeah. And we need to make sure that we're keeping individuals in control and ownership of the process as much as possible if we want it to be an enhancement to our democracy rather than a threat.
Definitely. And I think we're going to see brand new ways of measuring as are being born every day, so that we're going to get much more of an idea about the impact of the conversations that are occurring online. I've really enjoyed today. I'm sure everybody else has that's here. At least there was no heckling, just intellectual conversation and some intelligent questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
To the pub.